For the second half of our program, as those of you who saw the Post-Dispatch feature today on Nelson Wu know, Nelson Wu is a best-selling storyteller and novelist in the Chinese language. And tonight he's going to tell us some of his stories from his book, The Child.
Good evening. This is my first time in this building, and I so far enjoyed it very much, but I don't guarantee the next 40 minutes or so. I also have not had any time to get to know many people. I met Becky for the first time last week at the Casa concert. It was another enjoyable evening, but I thought it's a shame for a pretty girl like that to be sitting down all the time. I'm asking her to stand up for one moment and give, please do. And and to testify to the fact that we two have not rehearsed, but she will have this psaltery at her fingertips. Anytime she feels like it, she'll plug a few. I, therefore, at this moment, thought about a curtain raiser for a curtain raiser, a story that is not mine, but I learned about that happened in real life in Japan, where one of the many schools of koto players became so dilapidated that left only a mother and a daughter. The mother is very much of a veteran of a musician, performed under all kind of occasions. And at this one concert, it was a daughter going to play the main part, and the mother will support her with her koto. So it'll be a two koto, not exactly a duet. One is accomplishment, one is a main feature. The daughter is very brilliant, and when she really gets into the mood, being young, being gay, being pretty, she wanted to show off. And to do that, to claim almost in the equivalent of territory, to claim time, she will have to shed the mother and then go off on her own and play her brilliant and beautiful music. And at times, she would deliberately strike the discord so that the mother would be left behind. Well, the mother then, against a brilliant background, would be subdued and play very low, very soft, just waiting around. And then in this conflict was a beautiful harmony, and that was a lovely episode. But today, the old man is the one showing off, and the young girl is doing the supporting role. The stories come from a book called The Child and Other Cosmic Stories. It had come from the Chinese name Renzi, which has the benefit of the language, which does not differentiate a man-child or a woman-child. Does not occur to the Chinese like Lady Macbeth, unsex me. It was none of that. And in this title, years ago, I was discussing with an editor in this country when I was planning the English version. He said, well, what is the name of the book? I said, the most idiomatic, natural translation is Son of Man. But then was at the height of the liberation movement. So they say, you cannot do that. Why don't you say, Child of Man? So that's still not perfect. We decided it has to be a child of a person. And then I was a little worried that may really mutilate the English language. So we said, how about just call it the child? Then we're a little worried that might be classified as a medical book. So it's now the child and other cosmic stories. I notice in the audience there are many people from the Orient. They have read the original. There are many who have read the two I have published in St. Louis in our local magazines. Number 11 was published in St. Louis Literary Supplement, and number 10. Number 11 was published this spring in River Styx. I now would skip those two and tell you number 2, The Valley, very short. I use that as my true curtain raiser. It had a lot to do with light. The evening, the twilight, the dusk, the night, and then the dawn. Another story is longer. I never done it in this way because I like to have good knowledge about my audience. I know the quality of this audience, but I'm not so sure my story will really hold all your attention, but I'm going to give it a try. It's called The Prince, which is the main story of the book. The prince is a child. Those stories play on the theme, I should use a more serious word, centered around the theme of perfection. The concept is perfection. In the valley story, a perfection is achieved in a way other than the normal way. And so was the life of the prince. Now here I begin with the valley. It began with a traveler. All my stories for this whole group had a setting in the pre-industrial world. This story is meant to be cosmic, meant to reach out, cross the cultural boundaries. I'm very much interested in knowing where I can find that common nerve center, and I can manipulate that, massage that, so that people can understand each other. I gave the introductory sentence to that book, said, these stories are written for children. The emphasis is on children. These stories are written for children age 9 to 99. So today, ladies and gentlemen, you are little girls and little boys. And here comes the old traveler, naturally, on foot. Picture yourself 200 years back. Toward the end of the day, he came into a valley. And he, being a very experienced traveler, he knew there's no chance for him to go over the next range of mountains. So he decided to find a good place to rest. And he found in the middle of the valley, the land was flat and was very friendly, full of low grass. And he rolled up his clothing to form a pillow and lay his head on that and really stretched out, looking up at the sky. As the sky was getting dark, he began to see the grasses around him as black, silhouetted against the twilight of the sky. And he noticed something very strange, that all the plants around him seems to be of one species. They all are about a foot tall, with one stem, two leaves, some maybe with a third or fourth, but holding at the tip of the stem a flower bud. And this interested him. But he was very tired. He said, well, tomorrow morning, I'll look at them. They must be green. They couldn't all be black. He heard the birds beginning to quiet down. He heard the insects beginning to make new noises. And there's nothing but grayness around him, except at the opening of the valley where the river goes out, there was still a little flickering of light on the surface of the brook. But before he knew it, when he looked at that direction again, that little light disappeared also. And all of a sudden, he felt he was locked in by the ranges of mountain, and he lost track of where the opening of the valley is. And he felt very comfortable, very secluded, and he was ready to go to sleep. He looked up in the sky is dark, and they are full of stars. It is believed that whoever saw the stars before he closed his eyes for the night will have a smile on his face. And our traveler sleeps with a broad smile on his face. He did not know how long he slept, but he heard noises, very delicate, very soft voices around him. So he held his breath. He kept his eyes closed. He wanted to make sure he's not going to disturb anyone, but he also wanted to find out what this noise is all about. He noticed that these are very happy noises. They were not discussing him. He was not the center of their attention. So he slowly opened his eyes, and he saw nobody. And then he lifted his head off his pillow, tried to listen harder, and he could make out what they were talking about. It seems that all these little flower plants were talking. And the subject of their conversation that caused so much excitement, nobody was sleeping that night, was because, from what they have said, that all these flowers have their turn to blossom as the first ray of sunlight will strike them the next morning. Some of them will have blown the night before. Some of them are getting ready for the next evening, morning, and some others are waiting for their turn. The ones who are scheduled to blossom the next morning were the ones that got all the attention. They were such friendly, good spirits. The ones who were waiting to blossom listened to the ones that have had their flower the day before, tell them about their experiences. And the others listening in and share their aspirations. Because all of them will have to wait before dawn when some kind of messengers, he couldn't quite figure that out, will come and quickly tell each one what color she will bloom in. And then between that time and the moment the sunlight hits them, they have to do all the preparations and they'll burst into full bloom when it's light. So this was fine. And he listened. And then he became very used to the whole idea about this very great excitement, because each plant has only one bud, and that one flower is all they get in this whole life. I have to skip over quite a few details to say he stayed with this. He was determined to stay till daylight and see how this whole thing happened. About this time, when it was still fairly dark, but you sense from the breeze that dawn is not too far away, like a breeze at the tip of the plants sweeping over the valley, the voices of the plant died down and the messenger's voice was heard. First over there and then over there, and then come quite close to him. And it was something in such a friendly way, saying, "Oh, my little precious, you're going to be pink. And how lucky you are, pure white. Good luck to you. And my darling, you are going to be velvety and purple." Then this voice stopped before he could find out about what these little messengers look like. And just in front of him, one plant that is most perfectly developed somehow sensed that she's going to get special treatment. And she straightened out her body held up high her butt and was most adoring and attentive listening to the message going to give her. Well, it took no time at all. The messenger's voice said, "Here you are. You are the luckiest one of this whole valley and for this whole year. You are going to be given the permission to bloom in any color of your choice. Good luck to you. Goodbye, goodbye." They all disappeared. And then all the noises came up again. Nobody cared about their own color. Everyone congratulated this particularly lucky flower and want to know, "What is your favorite color?" She had many favorite colors. She had great ambition. She all of a sudden felt that she was given a great responsibility. All those childish little noises disappeared from her. She was like a princess becoming queen. She felt responsible. The honor of the whole valley is on her shoulder. She would become very humble, and she asked for opinions. Everybody gave her the very best suggestion. Some of those hard secrets guarded all the time are revealed to her. "Well, you may have this color. How beautiful it was." She listened and she listened. She said, "There are so many beautiful colors in the world, and there are so many possibilities of combination. I'm not going to fail you. I'm going to think my hardest. I'm going to use all the time and all the wisdom at my disposal to do this one thing. If this lucky assignment is given to any one of you, I expect you no less of you." So when others were getting ready, she was thinking. And as she looked at the sky, and the sky is getting a little lighter, she said, "I have to have the early decisions. I know this color is going to be so profuse, so gorgeous. Perhaps I will choose one of the gray colors that I always love so much, a very quiet color." She thought of 4 different grays. She thought of the dark sky a while ago that was charcoal gray and would be very nice in this surrounding. She thought of a pearl gray that pretty soon the sky would assume that color. She thought of a lead gray which will give a metallic sheen to it. As she was thinking, she looked up and the sky is beginning to turn into blue. She said, "This is my favorite gray. Inside the gray, there is hidden the color of light, of blue. I have these safeties. Whenever it happens, I'll just pick one of them." She didn't tell this to anyone. As she was holding on to this, like I would say, like the college applications, you always have a safety somewhere. She had it in her pocket. And then the eastern sky beginning to become dark, and the western hilltop beginning to get the first outline of light. And then still, the direct sunlight has not come into the valley. They all watch the shadow begin to come down the western hill, and then they follow the shadow to go into the valley. But they didn't know, right following that was the first ray of light hitting the western part of the sky and chased the shadow ever so swiftly. And then in the ear of the traveler burst into singing and song and laughter as his eyes beginning to perceive all this profusion of colors. He felt so happy, and the birds start to sing and the river start to gurgling. He sat up and he had the most wonderful morning, and the whole valley looked different in the morning than it was last night. There was no talking flowers. There was just birds and insects and the beautiful weather and the sunlight. And he was having a wonderful time. He stretched out his tired body and he was going to say, "Well, I'm going to start on my day's trip over that hill." And then he remembered he's forgotten something. There was something on his mind. And then he remembered he knew what it was. So he crouched down to look right in front of him. Was among all the flowers There was one little plant, beautifully developed, very straight, holding up a bud. It was colorless. As he was watching, that bud withered. Thank you. That's the verse. When my editor in the China Times in Taipei called me up after he read that story, and he said, "I've been meaning to write you a good long letter as to how much that story impressed us." I said, "Why didn't you write that letter to me?" He said, "Just like that little bud." The second story, I positioned it into a fictitious place, the name of which was first mentioned in the novel I'd written some 30 years ago, 33, 4 years ago. And I placed it in the general area to the south of the foothills of the Himalayas and to the north of Ganges River, the most ancient land. In this ancient country, there is a custom. They would pick the prince to be crowned at age 9. And they will let the world know about it on the child's 9th birthday. The reason to do that is very plain. All the good features and bad features of a child will be noticeable by the age 9. And in order to be picked to be king one day, he needs a long period of education. And on this day, in this land, a prince was to be crowned as crown prince at the age of 9. The night before, his mother had him in the palace, and taking his leave from his mother, he surrendered to the country. And the mother can only watch the next day's ceremony on the high scaffold inside the palace walls and looking out. What she sees is a large squarish platform with a small higher square dais in the middle of that. All around this platform are miniature temples representing the different regions where in the young prince's education he will have to travel. Normally the pilgrim will go to those places to pray at those temples, and today the gods came to witness the ceremony in their portable temples, and the young prince is left by his father to go and pay his homage to all the temples around the platform. It's a symbolic act so that in his travels, when he goes to their territory, he will be protected. His education involves an old Brahmin priest who will be his master, who will have the complete authority over him. And today, the prince will be given over to this old priest. The citizenry down below, the high officials, the court ladies, the ladies in waiting, all there waiting around for the ceremony to begin. The young prince was led by the father to be presented to the Brahmin priest who is on the high podium. He was so small. He was wearing all this heavy embroidery, gold and silver and silk. He had gold amulet that tie his sleeves together. His hair is done over on top of his head, his gold earrings, and his embroidered regalia. People of that country do not wear shoes, but to the palm of their hand and to the sole of their shoes is colored red with the finest rouge. And this is the way the little prince move about the platform. As he moves, the red color will flash in the eyes of the audience. And there's always a sign of appreciation to what kind of a good king one day this boy will make. The first lesson the old Brahmin priest told the crowd is the most ancient lesson a king must learn from the very beginning. It is how to separate the good from the evil, how to protect the good, and how to eliminate the evil. The little prince stood there, nodded his head, and took the lesson. And he became the pupil because he accepted the lesson. And then the king brought over a big sword, gave it to the priest to bless. After blessing it, he gave the sword to the young prince. He attached it to his belt, and then, struggling with his sword, it's too big for him, he pulled the sword out, as he was told, presented it in two hands to the Brahmin master, begging him to give him the first lesson of swordsmanship. The Brahmin intoned in the same solemn voice and said, "The swordsmanship has a name and is skilled as old as time. It's called the swordsmanship of how to distinguish good from evil." And he hold up the sword and he swing once to the left. He raised his left foot and he come down with the sword. As he bring the sword down, he said, "Ha!" And then he swing the sword to the right. And he come down the right-hand side and said, "Ha!" Then at this time, everybody seems to see in front of him must be the evil to be executed. And indeed, deep down from underneath his abdomen, he has worked up a breath of air as he swing for the third time and come down straight down the middle and say, "Ha!" You could almost see the evil split in half right in front of this old Brahmin. And the voice that he used is the void of admonition and punishment, and the void of execution. So he gave the sword to the young prince and said, "Now you do it." The little kid swung that heavy sword around one way and said, "Ha!" And one way that and said, "Ha!" And then, "Ha!" Sounds like playing with a little kitten. His voice is so full of love. And the citizenry again appreciate that, saying, "What a compassionate and a kind king we will have." Then the ladies-in-waiting came and took off the gold, the jewelry, the silver, the silks, the brocade, and put this brown color hemp monk, novice monk's gown over him. And he will from now on travel 6 years incognito, just like any other novice monk with the old master, all through the countryside to know the country, to learn the classics, to learn the holy books, to learn the swordsmanship. On the very first night when they left the capital city, they stopped in a small forest on a little hill where they can still hear, on the one hand, the noise of the city, on the other hand, the sounds of the night, of the nature. He thought he was going to lie down and sleep. Instead, the master taught him the lesson of how to spread the prayer rug, how to sit in a yoga position, and how to concentrate, and how to breathe. He was quite surprised and pleasantly so to find that he could get rid of his fatigue much faster that way. As the night gets darker, his master taught him how to see in the darkness by concentrating on what you want to see. And indeed, he began to find it possible, whether it's a tree or a rock or even an insect, he will see that in the darkness. And then he was taught how to hear. By the same way, he would hear as far away as a mile where a small animal would be scurrying over the foliage on the forest floor. So this is the way they begin their life. In the daytime, they go to the villages to beg for food. In the evening, they go to the forest to rest. And in the morning, he practiced swordsmanship. He learned everything very quickly. He learned the classics, he learned the philosophy, he learned holy books, and he learned his swordsmanship. But as he progresses so well, the old master became very worried. The very experienced teacher noticed that he learned the classics well because he loved the beauty of the classics. He learned the holy books well because he learned the beauty, loved the beauty of the religion. He learned the swordsmanship well because he learned and he loved the beauty of the movement in the swordsmanship. He has no use for any of this. He has no purpose. Even when he now says, ha, much louder, for which they have to go deeper into the mountain for their morning exercise, surprising the villagers to hear those noise coming from the valley, not knowing what is happening there, still, there's no purpose in this young man. By this time, he's about 12 or 13. One day, when they were again begging in the village, and they were at the front door of a very rich homesteader, a rich plantation owner. The servants were very rude, and the particular head servant, almost in a sadistic way, enjoyed being rude to beggars, even though he's a monk who has to beg for his food. Being very well trained, the young prince thanked them anyway, lowered his eyes, and walked away, just as he was told to do. But before they finished walking that single village street, there was commotion behind, was crying, there was shouting. So he turned around and see there was two beggars, a young girl and her young brother, two children beggars, also came to this door to beg. And the servants were even ruder to them than to the monk. They were being knocked on the floor as they rolled on the dirt roads to avoid harm. The vicious servant laughed. When the girl's clothes was torn, that head servant seemed to be enjoying himself. And the young prince, very sorrowful facial expression, beginning to contain the first inkling of anger. The Brahmin master was a very experienced teacher, and he looked at that. That was what he wanted to see, and it is there. So he quickly checked to see where is the right hand of the prince, and indeed, his hand is on the handle of the sword. The master was very pleased, and he ordered him, come with me. And the young prince, of course, habitually obeyed, leaves this scene, and the two of them go into the deep mountains. He said, today is the day I think you are ready. You're ready for what? You're ready to be granted the right to take life. And I'll grant that to you. But there are certain things I must tell you first. In your kind of swordsmanship, you must make the first strike. And the first strike must find its mark. If you don't, you will be killed because you are very close to your enemy. However, if you strike and then miss and be killed, it only constitutes a small regret because everyone dies in the end. If you should let go of the evil and kill by mistake the good, that will be a sin several reincarnations will not be able to resolve. The young prince thought he was not ready for this. But the master's mind was made up. He picked two little twigs and he planted them on the forest floor. On each of the twig, he attached a small piece of white cloth. On one, he wrote the beggar children. On the other, he wrote the bad servant. And then he said, now, regard this and be ready. And from now on, until the time I leave you, you always look toward me when the separation of good evil situation exists. And my signal to you is this good or evil? And then you go into act. He never knew his lessons will come to this kind of an application, but he was ready. So the master said, which one of this is good and which one is evil? And his sword is already in hand. He was so good, nobody could see how he did it. It was over his head. But at the same moment, a little whirlwind just came up from the ground from nowhere. And there was the leaves in the air and the little white flags of fluttering. And before he knew it, there was dust in the air. And then he began to hear voices. It was a scene of the daytime in the village. And the two sticks disappeared. And it was the crying of the children and the laughter of the servants. And he walked into this dusk storm looking for that bad servant. And as from one turn, here was that servant indeed with a sword. And he knew it was the time. Before the servant had the chance to pull the sword out, he was hot here and hot there, and down came the middle, and the servant was split into two. And then the dust storm disappeared. All he saw was that he split that little twig with the bad servant written on the flag right down the middle, and splitting that white flag into half. Normally when he does this, he does not pant, his heartbeat was normal, and his hand doesn't tremble. Here is one day he felt the whole thing is ugly. He has never made a decision so hastily without investigating the background of that servant. He killed a stranger, and the fact that he is alive and that twig was split into half because he was very well trained. And yet, when he was in this very depressed mood, he heard his master, who was very stingy about the words of praise, today said, excellent, excellent. Many of the seasoned swordsmen couldn't have done better. You are qualified. And I'm going to pray for the gods and spirits in the air that's going to pass over this point to testify that my pupil today will be given the right to kill. And he prayed after that. He said, please give me more wisdom. Please give me more judgment. And please let me do these things correct. I don't want to run into another situation like this. But between this time and the next year or two, there are tales everywhere about the Brahmin priest and the novice monk in the brown hemp gown going every places to eliminate evil, big and small, village, big and small, city, far and near. And then when the reputation was spread so far, whether it was this little prince monk or not, so long as people see a Brahmin priest and a novice monk following around, evil ceased to exist and everybody became very good. And one day they came by a body of water. And there was a ferry boat and the old ferryman on that boat. And they boarded the ferry boat and they rolled into the middle of the water, thinking that nobody knew who they were. And the ferryman looked at the prince straight into the eye and said, so you have eliminated all evil in the world. Now you want to go to the other side. The other side, everything is in reverse. good is evil, evil is good, and the life is death, and death is life. What are you going to do in the other world? This is a question he never thought of. He looked back at his master who sits behind him. His master had fallen deep asleep. And then when he looked at this ferryman, without saying it, but only in the mind, entertained the thought that, is this ferryman good or evil? The ferryman rolled over the side of the boat and left even with the oar. He was very confused. At the long end of this journey, he fell asleep too. They didn't know how long they drifted. One day they woke up near a bank and they heard the language spoken by the people were their mother tongue. They have come back to their country. So they hurry up and get off the boat and ask about what time it was. They knew they have a few days left for them to go back to the capital before the 15th birthday. So they were hurrying to that place. And they settled down on the same high point overlooking the city the night before. There was firework, there were firecrackers, music come in wafts with the breeze, and the smoke whitened the sky and reflecting the light down below. They sat and talked about this time, but the master became very, very quiet. He had many questions. He wanted to ask about that ferryman. He wanted to ask about his duties. He wanted to ask about the philosophies, but his master was very quiet, just watched the people go by, the peddlers, the farmers, the wives, the children, the other monks, all hurrying to the city for the big ceremony of the next day. They went in before the appointed time, stood among the crowd, and see the big platform rebuilt again after 6 years, and the ladies of the court have all his regalia ready, and his mother was on the platform looking out, and his father was waiting. When the 12 o'clock noon time arrived, the Brahmin priest led the way, going up the platform, and this time placed him on the high podium, and himself stood in front of it. He turned around and spoke to the crowd that you must have heard all the heroic deeds of a young monk who eliminated evil from the land. And I have brought your prince, that young monk, and his sword, the sword that's eliminating the evil, back to you. And here stands your young godlike prince who is going to rule your country after this last lesson. Presently, he turned back to the prince and said, Your Highness, am I good or evil? Am I good or evil? And he shook and he jumped and he split into two identical priests, the same dress, the same hat, the same gown, even the same beard. And then they said, Am I good or evil? Am I good or evil? The young prince picked up the sword. And he looked at them. There's no difference between the two of them. He had first thought, when the master wanted him to pull his sword out for the last lesson, meaning to eliminate some vicious minister in his father's court. In fact, before all of this happened, his eyes was not on his master, was surveying all the people in the crowd. Many of them did harbor some bad thoughts. Some of them had some harmless little cheating done at last night's card game. They all felt like to repent. In fact, in that silence, some of them even repent of their childhood little things like stealing eggs from the bird nest of the tree. He said to himself, all these are good people. I have no trouble with them. But he was taken by surprise by his own master. But this time his sword was held up in the air and the two were jumping back and forth. and he remembered what his master had said to him. If you strike last, you will be killed. And that is a small regret, because everybody dies. But if you let go the evil and kill the good, it will be a sin not resolved in many, many reincarnations. So he couldn't make up his mind, and he was looking at these two priests. Suddenly, the time is up. The two priests bump into each other and become one, and the priest jumped up on top of the platform, took the sword away from the prince, and ha, and ha, and split the prince into half. The prince didn't die, and there's no blood on the sword. He slowly rose, and he sat in the lotus position. When he was high enough in the air, he worshipped the four cardinal points. And then, with the human sentiment still in him, he bent over low and thanked his master. And with his sigh, he began to fly away. The master laid down the sword, fell on his knees, and said, "Excellent, excellent, the Son of Man has become a Buddha." And the voice, like waves to the countryside, everybody fell on their knees and said, "Excellent, excellent, the Son of Man is now a Buddha." Thank you very much. If I say we live in a cynical world, it will not be true. We live in a very beautiful world. But somehow we are capable of becoming cynical. For this once, I give you a sequel I have not written yet about this story of the prince. Several articles appeared in the newspaper and said, "What a shame, after all that work, the master killed this good prince. He would have been a very good king." So some of the writers said, "If I were the prince, I'd just pick one of them and chop him into half." So I have this little epilogue, which will take just a minute. So I said, "All right, you have the sword that will chop into half. I'll alter the early part of the story a little bit. Every time when he so carefully executes the evil, his sword gets heavier, brighter, and bigger as he grown to be a larger young man. And when he executes the evil, he stood there glowing light like a young god. But when he was at the last moment, this last test, he knew that he had and there are four. And he madly chopped away. There are hundreds of little masters of his education. And as you look at his sword, he become dull, colorless, and that long. I hope that will tell us that our world is a very good one, and if we can avoid that pitfall of becoming cynical. Thank you very much.